Okay, everybody, we're going to go ahead and get started. Maybe some people are traveling today and maybe they're just sleeping in. But we'll go ahead and get started with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this beautiful day, for the opportunity to meet. I thank you that you've given me things to do in your service today. Lord, I need your help to make it through the day. So please strengthen me, be with me, help me to be a good, faithful handler of your word, and help us all to grow, to sharpen one another as iron sharpens iron today. As we prepare to enter into our week of Thanksgiving, and we thank you for your many blessings that you shower upon us. In your name we pray. All right, so we're on our second to the last of our discussions about work and the wealth that we generate with work. And we've kind of been going through bits of the Bible, about trying to get an idea of what the Bible is teaching about the proper handling of wealth. Remember, we started out in Genesis talking about the fact that we were supposed to exhibit servant dominion as the viceroys of God, as his representatives for creation, but that early on in Genesis that gets substituted for serpent dominion, which is the wrong kind of dominion that we do not want to exhibit, because it doesn't exhibit the character of our Father in heaven, but rather the Father of this world, the devil. So then we talked about God's plan to rescue the world from this serpent dominion, and started in the Exodus, where the people of Israel were in slavery in Egypt, and he led them out of slavery, but into the wilderness, not into prosperity. And there in the wilderness, they had to learn humility, and they had to learn to follow the Lord and to trust in him, and not to keep looking back at the wealth of the world that they had left behind. We talked about briefly about the law and how the Lord instructed his people using the law in the proper use of their affluence, and this use exhibited a dependence on God, in particular in the way that they would rest on the Sabbath, that they would rest on sabbatical years, and particularly that they would reset and rest in the Jubilee year. We talked about the promised land that the Lord was leading his people into, that it was a land not of poverty, not of bare subsistence only, but it was a land of plenty. It was a land of joy, a land for rejoicing in the Lord. But along with the blessing of entering the promised land, there was a danger. And that danger was that the riches of the promised land would seduce their hearts to trust in their wealth. And we found out that, in fact, that is exactly what happened as they were in the promised land. They became seduced by their wealth. The rich became rich, took advantage of the poor, put their trust in their riches, in their wealth, just like the Canaanites, who were depending on the god Baal to give them wealth so that they could be prosperous. And then we talked about the fact that because of that, God judged his people in Israel and sent them into a reverse exodus back into slavery in Babylon and Assyria, which was going from the prosperity that they had, or the wealth that they had, the affluence that they had in the promised land, back into slavery again. So they made this whole circuit in the Old Testament of from riches to poverty to slavery to riches and back to slavery again. So the Lord has something to tell us about this transition between slavery and poverty. property and wealth, and how to handle each stage that we're facing. And then, so now today we're going to come to the Gospels. One thing I'd like to just tell you about the Gospels that I want to reflect on is this idea, particularly found in the Gospel of Luke, that Jesus is the fulfillment of Deuteronomy 18:18, where he is going to be a prophet like Moses, and he's leading his people out of slavery to sin and into the joy of the kingdom. And so he begins his journey. He starts in Galilee, and he sets his face toward Jerusalem and the cross and his death. But then from there, he goes, the church expands from Jerusalem to Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. So it's a journey to the cross and a journey from the cross to the kingdom, which is going to be very similar to the promised land that he was leading the Israelites into in the Exodus. So it's sort of a recreation, if you will, of the New Testament, of the Old Testament Exodus. And that's kind of the picture that we want to have. And I think that's a useful picture for seeing what he's trying to teach us about how to handle poverty and wealth in the New Testament. So I just wanted to talk for a moment then about this idea that there were a variety of poor people in the New Testament age. Okay, at the bottom of the poverty pyramid, if you will, there were the lame, the sick, widows, orphans, people that were not making it in the world, and they had to rely on the scraps that people would throw to them, on alms. They were dependent on others. They were the ones who were gleaning in the fields, like Ruth in the book of Ruth. They were just barely scraping by. Then there were the working poor. We talk about these, a lot of times we talk about these in the parable. They talk about these men, these day laborers who would be looking for work. And someone would come to hire them, and they would go to work in the field, and they would be paid a denarius, a day's wage, for their work, and that was enough to feed them and their family for that day. Those were the poor, those were the ones who were barely subsisting poverty. The other ones were kind of like almost enslaved. They were almost enslaved, right? Then there were the people of the land, the people that had their property, sort of like Ruth's mother Naomi. They had their land, but when hard times would fall upon them, that land would get gobbled up by the rich people who had sufficient stores to take over their wealth, and then they would be abused by the people that had all the wealth. So wealth was becoming increasingly concentrated into the hands of a few rich people who had the means of production. They had everything that they needed. My question to you is, what do you think, I guess the question for positing is, what was Jesus's financial status in that world?
So the picture is like, not you're not saying that Jesus was a kid.
This is Jesus as a kid, right?
Right.
Isn't it? Okay. So there's Jesus as a kid. He's working with Joe.
So you're asking when he's like in his 3-year ministry.
Okay.
So is that true?
He started out in this family, right? In the Holy Family, okay? He started out with Mary and Joseph, okay?
I'm assuming that's the peasants?
Okay. No, they weren't actually. So that was a different class of people, okay? They were neither rich nor poor, right? They were the working class, they were laborer, they were artisans. So Jesus was an artisan.
Tell me the difference between peasants and then the working class.
Okay. Working class are people that don't own any land.
Oh, okay. Then
and they go to work on somebody else's field. The peasants were people that owned the land but their land had been carved up by the rich, and so they had less and less and less, and they were barely scraping by on this little bit of land that they still had left. Okay? So we have peasants working in the countryside. They had a stable, they had stable work, and they would work and, you know, plow their fields, and, you know, they'd be dependent on year to year how well the weather was in order to yield a harvest. Okay? Day laborers would go to work in the rich people's farms. Okay? Poor people didn't have any money to hire the day laborers to come work in their farm. The rich people did. They'd hire them, and they would gather their crops, you know, get them into the barns for the rich people, and then the rich people would say, "Wow, you've got a great deal of good things laid up by you. I don't know what I'll do. I'll build bigger barns," right? We've heard this story, right? We're going to talk about it in a second. Okay, so there were rich people, there were poor people, there were very poor people that were just scraping by that didn't have any land. They didn't have any riches that they could rely on to live. They had to go out day by day and try to find work. And then there was these artisans, okay? And Jesus was in an unusual position of being an artisan, as being a carpenter. He built things, okay? And actually, in the day of Christ, so just a little bit before Jesus became an adult, the Romans destroyed the city of Sepphoris, which is really close. It's the biggest city in Samaria, and it's really close to Nazareth. And then they rebuilt it, and made it into this magnificent city, this magnificent Roman city. So there was a lot of building and construction going on at the time, and so carpenters, particularly local carpenters, would be in demand. So Jesus came from a family that wasn't really what you would call poor. They weren't rich, but they weren't poor. And, you know, most of us would think, well, you know, I mean, I didn't get to pick my parents, and you grow up in the family you grow up in. Jesus got to pick what family he was going to be born in. Okay, I joke with people a lot of times when they inherit bad genes, you know, bad genetic tendencies. You know, when you were a baby, you just picked your parents poorly, you know? But Jesus did pick these parents. He picked this socioeconomic status to be born into. And he was a middle-class kind of guy in a world that didn't have much of a middle class, yeah.
But when Jesus was born, his parents couldn't afford, like, there was a normal thing that they were supposed to pay, but they did the one that was
They did the poverty tax when Jesus was first born. But remember, a couple years after that, they get visited by the Magi, right? And they get gold, frankincense, and myrrh. That actually has some monetary value. And then they go down to Egypt, probably financed by those, that money. And then they came back up to Nazareth, where there was all those building projects, right? So he started out in a relatively poor family. They became more affluent, probably. And here he was. He's the oldest son of a stable, two-parent family. Not a widow. He's not an orphan, okay? He's got a business that is profitable and that is enough to secure him his daily bread. But what does he do? What does he do after he sees John the Baptist? Do we still see him working in his wood shop? No, he leaves it behind. He leaves all that behind. He was well enough off, and he left. So then, the Son of Man doesn't have a place to lay his head. Foxes and birds, I forget, have their nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Okay, he renounced a secure position for an insecure position. Okay, so he renounced it. He went from affluence to poverty in a voluntary way. So I think that's probably something that's important to recognize. I mean, not only did Philippians 2, if you look at it, it kind of traces the whole picture, right? Because he starts up here, right? He did not deem equality with God something to be grasped And I would say that means something to hold on to, because he already had it. Right? He let go of the privileges of being the second person in the Trinity and took the form of a man. That's a big drop. He could have been any man that he wanted. He could have been Herod's son, but he chose to be Joseph and Mary's son. Okay? He could have been Caesar's son, for all that matter. But he chose somebody kind of in the middle, and then he kind of lets go of that. Right? And he relies on other people for his food and water, and he travels land preaching the good news of the kingdom. And then he drops that and takes the form of a slave. And more than a form of a slave, a convicted felon, and he's executed on a Roman consequence. So we see him going from riches to poverty to death. And then he rises. Okay? And I think it's just important to remember, you know, the author of Hebrews tells us that he headed toward the cross, not because he wanted the cross, for the joy that was set before him. He was looking beyond the cross, beyond the wilderness to the promised land, beyond the suffering to the joy. Okay? So there's this tangent of proceeding through suffering, through hardship, to blessing, and keeping that in mind. Okay? Now, what I'd like you to take just a minute, this is a really important discussion because it is ongoing. It's a really big discussion. And that is, there's really kind of two ways people have to looking at wealth. Okay? There's people that say, hey, wealth is bad. We are so wealthy, we have become corrupt. And anybody that has wealth is guilty of taking advantage of the people who don't have wealth. You really can't, if you're benefiting from this situation where you have wealth and privilege, you're guilty and you need to make reparations to the people who don't, who have been poorly treated by that system that brought you wealth and blessing. There are also, then there's the flip side of the coin is those who say, health, wealth, and prosperity gospel, you're sons of the king, God wants you to be blessed, okay? Name it, claim it, go out and get it, you know, get all the blessing that you can have because God wants you to be rich. And I think we need to wrestle with this just a little bit. So, would you wrestle with that just a little bit? Do you think that the people who are talking about systemic racism and taking advantage of other people unfairly and treating people unfairly, even if it's not directly, so even if it's not intentional, just because of your privilege that you were born to, are you in need of making reparations? Or do you think... do you think that you should really just enjoy the things that you have and be grateful to the Lord for having you? Why don't we take a few minutes and talk about that very easy question? Okay? Okay. So, anybody have anything that they'd like to share? They've got this problem nailed, solved. Signed, sealed, delivered?
I'm buying some land and we're starting a new government.
Sounds good. Okay.
This will be destroyed in a couple hundred years.
Get yourself a farm in South America and, you know, set it up and prepare for the end of the world, right? So, to start with in the gospel, I want to take you to Luke chapter 6. You know, Luke probably... has the most to say about wealth and how it's handled. And you know, I find that, and it's a lot of it seems pretty critical of wealth and the wealthy. And so we need to really look at it because, you know, who did Luke write his letter, his gospel and the Acts too? Who is it addressed to?
Theophilus.
Who is Theophilus? Don't know?
Most excellent.
Most excellent Theophilus, God-loving. Okay. Probably his sponsor, right? Probably some wealthy guy that was sponsoring the work that he was doing and sponsoring the writing of this. And it was probably a guy that had some money and maybe had some doubts about his Christian faith and how he ought to be handling it. So he probably has a message for somebody that has some money as well as for the poor. He probably wasn't a poor guy that was sponsoring him for writing this work, because the poor guy didn't have any money to spend on giving him money to write the work, to support his work. Okay. But you remember in Matthew's gospel, he said, blessed are the poor in spirit. Okay? But Luke says it differently, right? In his sermon on the plain. So he says to him, and he lifted up his eyes to the disciples and said, blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you shall be satisfied. Blessed are you who are weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when men hate you, and when they exclude you and revile you, and spurn your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day, and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. For so their fathers did to the prophets. Okay. So what's his point about the poor and the hungry and those who are persecuted? What's the point? Point is, it's going to reverse it. You're poor now, but you're not always going to be poor. You're going to be rich. You're hungry now, but you're not going to be hungry later. You're going to be fed. You're persecuted now, but you're going to share in the joy of the kingdom. Okay? The point is to look beyond your circumstances and see something better than material wealth that you can have in this life. So the point is the focus. He's not saying, blessed are you poor because it's better to be poor. He says, blessed are you poor because you're going to be rich. So that's part of it. You know, a lot of times people have said that, this was the idea in the Middle Ages, that what you need to do is you need to renounce your wealth, embrace poverty, live a life of bare subsistence, because this is going to earn you favor with God, right? That was the whole point of the monastic movement. It was a mistake, okay? You cannot earn God's favor by giving up stuff. You can't, okay? You can do things with that stuff, and that's sort of the point. So I want to bring us to just a couple of parables. Okay? The Lord taught about wealth and poverty in parables. The reason he taught in parables was this was something that his followers could understand. But others could hear it and they wouldn't get nothing from it. They would not understand. So he talked to them in parables so that they would, his followers would understand. But the crowd was bewildered by it. Okay? We're going to start with Luke chapter 12, and he gives the parable of the rich fool. And I'm just going to read through stuff for you so you can understand that. Unless anybody wants to read, you can feel free to jump in. But chapter 12, verses 13 to 34, okay, parable of the rich fool. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made you me a judge or arbiter over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard for all covetousness, for one's life
does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. And he told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, what shall I do now? For I have nowhere to store my crops. And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax. Eat, drink, be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the thing you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. So, first thing I just want to point out to you, see, these two guys, this is incipiated by this, these two guys having an argument over their inheritance. Okay? So presumably, their father has died. Alright? And the younger son is saying, hey, he's supposed to give me my portion. What should he be thinking about when his father died? His father. Right? This is a spiritual challenge. All you can think about is money. How much of it I'm gonna get. And we certainly see that often enough, right? And then, you know, the most ironic thing about it, to me, is that Jesus says to him, hey, who appointed me as arbiter over you? Well, actually, I know who appointed Jesus as arbiter over him. Okay? I know who. And he was arbiter over him. But here he is actually rejecting him, right? For the condition of his heart. Okay? But the point is, look at this guy. This guy was a rich man. His barns were full. He could already eat, drink, and be merry. And he could expect that next year he could eat, drink, and be merry too, even if he didn't have a plentiful harvest. Okay? What he's doing isn't storing up for the future. Like, you know, I read this, I thought, does this mean you shouldn't have a retirement? Okay? You're planning ahead for the future? No. This guy already has a future as far as he can see. He's got productive land. He's got barns full of grain. He doesn't have to worry about his life. He's got more. He says, what do I do with it now? Oh, well, I'm going to really live it up. Right? Because he doesn't think, could there possibly be anything else that I could do with excess wealth than hoard it? Right? So, there's the problem. It's not that he has wealth. It's not that he stores wealth. It's that he can't think of what else to do with blessings than pouring on himself. And you know what? He couldn't eat, drink, and be merry with the stuff he already had before that harvest, before the day he was going to die, which was tomorrow. Right? The things that you can spend your wealth on are passing before our eyes. They're like a vapor, right? Material things, they seem so tangible. They're not, okay? The only thing that's tangible, the only thing that's real are spiritual things. And so enjoy the blessings that God has for you this day and put your faith in Him to provide for you tomorrow. That's the bonus. That's it, right? Okay, next one I want to talk to you about is this parable of the shrewd manager. That's in Luke chapter 16. And I thought this is a crazy parable, right? Luke 16 verses 1 through 9, okay? He also said to his disciples, there was a rich man, again a rich man, who had a manager. And charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be my manager. And the manager said to him, What shall I do since my master is taking my management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. And I am sure today I've decided what to do. So that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses. So, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures a wheat. He said, take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness, for the sons of the world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into an eternal dwelling. So, tricky parable, right? Jesus praises this dishonest manager. Okay? And you're going, gosh, you know, this guy should be thrown in jail, right? He's embezzling from the master. And yet, he commends him for doing this. What do you, well, look, I'm going to not force you guys to talk to the big group businesses. I'm just putting you on the spot. I got another discussion to break up you with. Anyway. So the thing is, as far as I can tell from reading this parable, okay, what the guy did was he took his wealth and paid off the debts of other people that they had to make them indebted to him rather than keeping the money. Why? Because he could look forward and say, I got no more money coming in. I got nowhere to turn. I need to invest in the future. I need to put my trust in something other than possessions, because I can't carry enough possessions to keep me going forever. So he's investing in the future. He's setting aside his material wealth that he had made as a manager toward the day when he will no longer be able to make that money or to have any income. So it's a looking forward, not hanging on to your wealth, but looking forward to something that you can rely on in the future. So it's sort of a spiritual investment, if that makes sense to you. You're going to be relying on the goodwill of these people who are going to owe you favors to be able to care for you when you're later in need. So that's the point of the shrewd man. Okay?
But then he wouldn't be called dishonest, right?
Well, remember this is a translation, okay? And the word used doesn't really imply dishonesty. It was not trustworthy, okay? He was not a trustworthy manager. He may have been a lousy manager. He may have been bad. Okay? Or he might have been loaning to people that the master had loaned to at a lower interest rate so that he was skimming a little off the top. You know, so limiting what his boss would make with his own little side business, which was fairly common. Yeah?
I'm just seeing, and I think it's just the title. Like the not
entire
text is calls
him the parable dishonest. Well, the word dishonest does appear in verse 8 in the ESV translation. So if you look at it, it does call him a dishonest manager. But the point is, it's really difficult to understand this parable if you're thinking, well, the guy's stealing from him, and Jesus is saying it's a good thing to steal from the boss. I don't think that's what the Lord is saying.
Is there any indication that the manager is supposed to be a representation of God or the perfect person?
Well, he's definitely a manager. Okay,
right.
He's managing the master's property.
I'm sorry, I'm thinking of the master. That the master is supposed to be a correct person in his response.
The master, if you look at it, the position of the master is the position of. Okay, he's saying God's the master. You guys are the dishonest manager. Okay,
well, that's what I'm asking, because verse 13 then talks about two masters.
Yeah. So who's the? You know, what he's saying is okay. So the dishonest manager could have put his faith in his money that he already had. Okay, in the treasure that he already had, but instead he relies on the obligation. He has a spiritual treasure that he's traded for. And he says, that's shrewd in an earthly way. Okay? And he says,
in a spiritual way, you are not as shrewd as this dishonest manager is, because you're putting your trust in your goods that you have here that you can't keep, and not putting your trust in the Lord who has eternal treasures in store for you. Okay? So that's the point. Not so much that, you know, it's not a condemnation of what he did wrong that he's being fired by the master for. And the reason is, it doesn't even specify what he did wrong. Pretty sure he did something wrong, because he doesn't argue that he didn't do anything wrong. And the master says, you're fired, and he's planning on, okay, now what do I do? Okay, so probably it's reasonable to assume that he didn't do a good job. Right? Difficult text. Okay? But, you know, once again, we're talking about what are you going to do with the stuff that you already have, with the wealth that you already have, and how are you going to deal with that? Is that going to hold you, or are you going to use it to invest in your future? So he wants you to invest in your future. And then we've got right after that, is the story of Lazarus and the rich man. Okay? I think we know the story of Lazarus and the rich man. Okay. You know, so Lazarus is rich, and he dies, and he goes to Hades. And, I'm sorry. The rich man dies and goes to Hades. Lazarus also dies and goes to the bosom of Abraham, wherever that is. Okay? And I won't discourse on that, because it's irrelevant to the point I'm trying to make. Okay? And they're having this conversation. Okay? And what was wrong with what the rich man did? Was it wrong because he was rich?
No, he never shared anything. His heart was selfish.
Okay. Here's the thing, okay? Lazarus is there. He's in pathetic condition. This man knows his name. He knows Lazarus' name. And yet he has nothing to help him. He won't even let him eat the droppings from his table that the dogs eat. Okay? So Lazarus, the rich man, was not concerned with Lazarus, even though his suffering was, as we said, morally proximate. He's right there, suffering right in front of your face, and you did nothing to help him. Okay? Now, and who is the rich man talking to when he's in Hades? Who's he talking to?
Abraham.
Abraham was a poor guy, right? No, Abraham was rich. We talked about that already. Abraham was rich. The problem isn't being rich or being poor. The problem is not caring about other people that you're in a position to help. And that's the point that Abraham makes to him. He said, you were in a position to help me. You didn't help him. Okay? He says, oh, well, you know, I understand that. Could you just send Lazarus to put some water on my mouth? So even then, oh, he's in Hades. Being punished for not treating Lazarus right, he still thinks Lazarus is there for him. Send Lazarus to put, you know, to moisten my tongue, because I'm uncomfortable. Send Lazarus to go talk to my brothers. He's, you know, Lazarus is supposed to take care of the problem, because he's the rich guy, Lazarus isn't. So that's the point, is this thinking that being wealthy puts you in a position where you're able to lord it over other people. This is improper. Okay? Alright. And then I wanted to quickly talk over. Yeah, we got enough. Okay. I want to talk about the issue with the rich young ruler. That's another chapter, a couple chapters, chapter 18. Okay? You know the story of the rich young ruler. Okay? He runs up to Jesus, says, falls at his feet, says, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus says, hey, what are the promises? You know, what do you mean to the commandments? Which one? You know, you shall not kill, you shall not steal, you shall not commit adultery. All of these things that I've done for my youth. And he says, well, you want one thing only. Sell your possessions, give them to the poor, and come and follow me in heaven. So, this is a complex quandary, right?
do we have to sell all our riches, all our possessions to follow Jesus and have eternal life? That's the question. Okay? It's at least a reasonable question, right? And what does Jesus say to his disciples? They say, well, if such is the case, how can anyone be saved? Right? And Jesus says, he says it's easier pastor for a camel pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go to heaven. And they say, well, if this is the case, then how can anyone be saved? And he says,
what is impossible with man is
possible with God. Okay? It's possible with God for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. And then he goes on, we don't recognize this because we don't read it this way, but the same chapter, okay? The same chapter, Luke chapter 19, or the next chapter, he's talking about Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus, the wee little man, right? Zacchaeus, the wee little man, was, guess what? A rich man, okay? And he was a tax collector, and he had cheated people, okay? And he's hanging up in a tree to try to see Jesus because, you know, he's heard these good things about him. And Jesus says, hey, you know, invites himself to his house, all right? And then they cut to the scene where Zacchaeus is saying, I'm going to take half of what I own, and I'm going to give it to the poor. And if I've defrauded anybody, and I'm sure I have, I'm going to pay back fourfold what I stole from you. What does Jesus say? He says, no, you've got to give up all that you have and follow me, right? No, he does not say that, right? He says, this day, salvation has come to this house. Because this man, too, is a son of Israel. Why? Because he repented of the trust that he had put in his wealth. He's dumping it. Okay? He's giving up 50% of what you owe. Nobody ever told, there was nothing in the law that says you give 50% of what you own to the poor. No one. Does it ever require that? Okay? But he says, I'm going to give half of it away, and the rest, I'm going to dole out to these people that I've cheated, and he's going to pay it fourfold. You know, paying somebody fourfold, that's what you pay when you rob somebody at gunpoint. That's what you pay. Fourfold. That's the penalty. If you cheated somebody, you're supposed to pay double when you found out. Okay? He's going to pay them back fourfold. But he says, I'm guilty. I shouldn't have done this. I should have been a better steward of the wealth that the Lord gave you. Did he say you need to give up your job as a tax collector? No. Okay. Hey, let me tell you something. With a guy like Zacchaeus as the chief tax collector in and around Jerusalem, do you think there was a little change in the way taxes were collected from that point on? The people that worked for him? Probably, okay? He had an impact in the situation that he was in by trusting not his ill-gotten gain, but in the Lord. And his promises, okay? So that's the point, is that we need to shift our focus away from relying on our stuff to relying on the Lord and his provision and his promises. Not because it's good to be poor, but because the Lord is leading us to real wealth and real prosperity and real joy. And this fake joy that you can have with the stuff that you have today is it won't light a candle to the feast, to the banquet that the Lord of Delight has prepared for us. So that's the point. And then I want to finish up, once again, same chapter, right after Zacchaeus, with the parable of the 10 minas. Okay? And the parable of the 10 minas, or the 10 talents, if you will, the master is going away and he loans out his money to the servants. One gets 10, one gets 5, one gets 1. And he goes away and then he returns. And the servants that are praised have invested his blessing, his money, the minas that they've been given, for the furtherment of his master's estate. They're working for the kingdom with the money that they've been given, and they yield a harvest back to that. At the end, he says, "Well done, my good and faithful servant. You've been faithful in few things. Now enter into the joy of your master, who will be faithful in many. I will now put you in charge of many things." Okay? Whereas the one who got just one mine, he says, "Hey, I know that you're a tough guy. You reap where you don't sow, and so I buried it. And here's my message. I didn't do anything with it, but it was safe. And here it is baptized. But you're worthless, sir. You didn't do anything with what I gave you. I'm going to take it from you and give it to one that had 10 minas. Now he's got 20, and he had 21. Because to whom much is given, the one who's been given much will be given more, and the one who's been given little will be given nothing at all." You're like, "Wow, that doesn't seem right. The Lord does not sit the way we think, does he?" Okay? You expected the point of the 10 minas. Okay? And this is really important. Okay? You're supposed to take the riches, the treasure, the blessing that the Lord has given you in this life, today, now, and invest it in his kingdom for his good, his glory, forever. If you do that, you're going to be rewarded more than what you had here. A lot more. Okay? We're like kids playing in the sandbox. We don't know what treasures the eye has not seen, nor ear heard, what the Lord has planned for those who love him. So we need to invest the riches that we've been, that have been put into our hands. And we're almost done, but I'm going to let you guys take a few minutes just to talk among yourselves, but we're not going to get back together at the end because we're about out of time, so let's just pray for a moment. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the Gospel of Luke. We thank you for what he has to teach us about wealth and how we handle wealth. We thank you for the wealth that we have been gifted with, that has been entrusted to our hands. Help us to have an eternal perspective to know and the wisdom to choose to use the wealth that you've given us to the furtherment of your kingdom and your mission. And we ask you to see this.